This is the No Dogma podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined from San Francisco by Terence Ryan, developer advocate for Google. Thank you very much for joining me, Terry.
Well, thanks a lot for having me, Brian.
Can you tell me a little bit about your background and what you do at Google, please?
Sure. Well, currently at Google, I'm a developer advocate for Google Cloud Platform, which means I spend half my time fooling around with the tools and technology in Google Cloud Platform, and then the rest of my time I go out and talk about it. Trying to convince developers from bottom up to take a chance on it, and, like, fool around with it, play with it. I don't necessarily do sales. It's more trying to get people to play around with it. And coming from a position of being an actual developer, as opposed to, like, someone who doesn't, you know, someone who just kind of knows the spread presentation.
I met you a couple of weeks ago in New York when you were giving a presentation. The presentation was titled something like Driving Technical Change. Is that something that's part of your remit at Google, or is that something you have a personal interest in?
A little bit of both. I wrote this book fresh out of spending time at the Wharton School of Business. I was a staff member of the Wharton School of Business. I'm in no way, shape, or form allowed to say that I attended it. Between my time at Wharton and my time at Adobe is when this book kind of got written. And it is about personal things, but the idea of persuading people to take on new tools and new technology is certainly a important part of what I've been doing for the past 6 years and now with my time at Google. So it is something I spend, you know, pretty much every day thinking or worrying about in some way, shape, or form.
Do you have a definition for what you mean by driving technical change?
Sure. Well, driving, it's just kind of easy, you know, like pushing an idea inside an organization. But when I say technical change, I mean any sort of change in the way people are doing things. It could be a tool, a technology, a technique. So, you know, way back when I was starting this, there were a lot of, it was before DevOps had become really big. And so the idea that you'd have to push either a version control system or a technique like code reviews on a what I would call a web development shop wasn't certainly obvious at the time. So that's what I mean. Like anything that, like, saves you time or changes the technology stack or helps in the production of code and or related technologies, or it could be systems thing. Basically, anything that is anything that you're trying to push in that's either about technology or a technology and that you're trying to push on an organization. And push is a hard, harsh word there, but you know, advocate for inside an organization is probably the better way of putting that.
I've worked with a lot of developers who advocate left, right, and center for their favorite things, whatever it happens to be, introduction of Git, removal of something else. It isn't always necessary what should be done. So I presume you must have maybe a bigger picture in mind when you're talking about driving some particular change.
So yeah, that's a whole other book, right? Like whether or not the change you're pushing is the correct change, and it's very situational, right? Like in many organizations, Git is the right answer. In some organizations, it's not going to be the right answer for many, many reasons. And they may be technical. They may be, back when, 5 years ago, Git versus Mercurial, there was sort of a, you know, if you were in a Windows shop and you're pushing Git instead of Mercurial, you really would have to ask the question, are you making the right choice here for your organization? Now, as things would have it, you actually were probably right, but you didn't have you didn't have 20/20 hindsight to prove it. So yeah, whether or not you're pushing the right technology is something you have to very carefully decide. So I have a book about all this, and I'll certainly plug it later. But one of the chapters is like just some basic sanity checks, like, you know, is this something you're adopting because it is something that you want to use, or do you actually see it as being something better? Like taking a whole shop of people that are experts in, let's say Ruby, and everything's working fine, but there's like slight problems. Pushing the entire staff to say go, while maybe attractive to some people, wouldn't necessarily be the right choice, right? So you really have to make sure that you're not just pushing a technology for technology's sake, which is not to say don't try new things, but it means, you know, implement them and encourage them in ways that make sense for your organization. Getting everybody on a giant project to switch languages mid-project, probably not the best use of your efforts for driving technical change. On the other hand, you're starting a greenfield project and you get sort of carte blanche to do what you want to do. Introducing a new language there might be, you know, a better thing to do. So, you know, make sure you're tilting at the right windmills.
But let's stick with that example for one moment, though. Let's say you have a greenfield project and you have some developers pushing for Go and some developers pushing for Ruby and some developers pushing for something else. Is it going to be the person who's in the position of authority that makes a decision, or would you advocate a different approach?
In those types of scenarios where you have large groups of people and they're all advocating for, you know, not the same thing, it's going to have to come down to someone in a position of authority speaking, you know, saying like, all right, this is, you know, at a certain point, someone's got to make the decision of what language it's going to be written in. And that's probably not, it's going to be sort of the project lead. Now, on a small project, that's the developer, that, you know, there's one developer and they're the project lead, and that's great. When you have more than one developer on it, you're going to have somebody who makes those calls. So I always see this process as being a very bottom up. Because when you have top down authority, you can mandate certain things, and you don't want to pull that card all the time, just because it's messy and it has a political and personal cost. But you can do it. But the better thing is when you're going bottom up to persuade people to actively join over, and then by definition, you're not going to have authority when you go to do that. So whether or not you have authority is just going to change sort of – unless you're just going to come out and mandate it straight out, whether or not you have authority doesn't really change the way you would approach this, except that last, you know, except the, you know, mandate stage.
So one of the things you mentioned during your presentation a few weeks ago was seeking out allies. Is it time to seek out the allies before you attempt to introduce a change, or after you've made your proposal more public?
I think knowing who might be on your side ahead of time is usually a good, you know, like don't the lawyer, you know, the lawyer thing is don't ask a question that you don't know the answer to. And sort of the same thing, like don't ask a group of people whether or not they'd want to go to Ruby or you know, to some new technology, whatever it is, without knowing what their answers would be. Now, when you work with a group of people for a long time, which is a lot of what these relationships are, you kind of know, like, this group of people, they never want to try the new thing. And, you know, these guys are always on board. And so you'd probably be talking to them about it before anyway. You should know before you start, like, a organized campaign of driving technical change, you should know where people are going to shake down. And actually, in the book and in the talk, I outline, like, a sort of a pattern set up, like a pattern language for what I call skeptics. And basically you want to assign people to what role they're going to play in your process of driving technical change at the onset. So that is definitely something you want to do at the onset of your campaign to drive technical change.
So we're talking about the skeptics. That was something you covered extensively. You had categorized the skeptics into, let's say, having various kinds of reasoning and then the way you could challenge those. Can you run through a few of the types of skeptics that are out there that you've encountered?
Sure. So there, you know, at the beginning, it starts sort of obviously with uninformed people that aren't informed about your technology. And it's important to note, actually, when I start talking about skeptics, that these are to some degrees caricatures. And they're not meant to, you know, real people are much more complex, but they are a helpful way of sort of categorizing people so that you can learn to deal with them a little bit easier, a little bit better. So uninformed is like the most obvious type. They don't know about the technology. And then there's, groups like the cynic, who is sort of a devil's advocate. Then someone who we would call, burned, who has tried the technology before. And then those are all rational types. There's a whole bunch of them. I won't go through all of them, but they're rational. They have legitimate arguments that they are honestly putting forth. And then there's one last type, which are called the irrational, which basically it may or may not be a – no, I'm sorry. It will not be a rational reason. It will not be something that you can argue your way through. Maybe like the first day of work, you tick them off and they've been your like mortal enemy ever since. Or maybe you're a female or a minority and they're sexist or racist or classist. And they know they can't come out and say like, I'm not going to listen to her because she's a woman. So instead they're going to masquerade as one of the other types. And that becomes very challenging. Like, so you start dealing with them as, you know, maybe the arguments they're putting forth are cynical arguments. So you start dealing with them as they're a cynic. And then all of a sudden they change their mind. But instead of becoming converted, they become a different type. Like they suddenly become they're cynic. They suddenly remember they tried the technology, it didn't work. That one's a little obvious. But there's a couple other types that they can change into. So basically, you have to watch for people that are changing types often, and then realize that they're irrational. And then the overall strategy for the irrational people is once you identify them as irrational, don't waste any effort on them. You can ignore them for the time being.
But for the more rational kinds of people, what are the approaches? Sorry, the more rational skeptics.
Sure. So I have a whole bunch of tactics, and they're pretty. Some of them are common sense. A lot of this stuff is common sense, and a lot of this stuff is maybe not entirely common sense. But it's things like become an expert in the technology, right? So if you're going to push a particular technology package, let's say Git. You need to be the Git expert at your location. And it's not, in the case of bottom-up advocacy, it's not necessarily about like knowing everything. It's about being able to shortcut people when they have when they hit the roadblocks with learning, right? So there's an early stage in learning a new technology where it's not that you don't understand like the basics. It's that you don't know how to ask the right questions about the technology. You know, for example, if you're coming to you're switching from Nginx to from Apache to Nginx, which, you know, reasonable technology switch and kind of common these days, and you don't know like how Nginx is configured. Like you don't even know, like you're used to htaccess. And so you want to say like, oh, well, the question you want to ask is how do I do something like htaccess in Nginx? Maybe you can do it, maybe you can't. But unless you understand the right question to ask, and that's an easy one, right? You just go on Google and say htaccess for Nginx and you'll get answers for it. But a lot of times those things aren't, you know, because someone who learns a technology and is blogging about it and talking about it and putting stuff on the net about it might not have come from another technology stack. And so those types of questions aren't answered. So if you can be the person that says, oh, you're asking about this sort of concept in this technology, we call it a completely different thing, and that's okay. And you basically can shortcut them because that's the type of search that's kind of hard to do. And, you know, I'm working for the company that should be able to do that. But that, we don't always do that one really well. So translating it from one technology to another, you need to be the person that can do that for them, especially when you're trying to get them to switch from something as opposed to pick something new. That was a long answer to a short question.
But that would then mean that if you're going to advocate a change, you're saying you need to be an expert. You need to be able to answer the questions, assure people, explain how it can scale or how it's not going to cost as much or whatever it happens to be. Be ready for all the arguments.
Exactly. That is one of the techniques. And it's important to know that's just one of the techniques. And that'll work on a lot of people, but that won't necessarily work on, like, for example, one of the skeptic types that I didn't mention was a boss. As any decision maker, and their challenge with coming at this is that you're advocating technical change and that is not their bailiwick, right? So you could be an expert all you want on it. That's not going to necessarily help you with a boss, where it will help you with the cynic and it will help you with the burn because, you know where they went wrong and, you know, all those sorts of other things. So there's a whole bunch of these techniques. And there are some that are, so anyway, Yeah, there's a whole bunch of these techniques.
But I think the boss is a very good example. I've worked in a company where I had enormous opposition to introducing entity framework. And it was from colleagues, it was from engineering management, and it was even from the CTO. I opposed it and I fought it, but in the end, you know, it became a draw on my energy and a draw on my time. What could I have done better in a scenario like that, if it was possible to do better?
Sure. Well, who knows? Yeah, it's hard to second guess, you know, what you did, you know, somewhere else. But so first off, what I sort of say is the strategy we have out is you ignore the irrational first, right? So leave them aside. And then you go after the people that are relatively easy to change their minds. And they're sort of the ones, the skeptic types we talk about early in the presentation and in the book, which are uninformed, the herd, burn, time crunched, and so on. And like basically get over those to your side that you can. So when you make the argument, you have a whole bunch of people that are already willing to say like, yes, we want to do this. This is a good thing. Then once you do that, you go after some of the harder types, like, I guess like the burned and the boss, put them towards the boss. I'm sorry, the burned and the time crunch, put them towards the end. And then the last person you try to convince, is the burn or the boss. Now, the reason why you put them last is because you have all these allies, you have all your coworkers who are saying like, we want this thing. So already you don't have that question of like, wait a minute, why are you the only one who wants this? Like, no, I'm not the only one who wants this. There's, you know, there's a whole group of people that want this change. All right. So with the boss, your challenge and your what you need to accomplish is to take your technology and make it a solution to their problems, not necessarily a solution to your problems. So frameworks. This may not represent what was going on with your org. So I'm just gonna jump on frameworks, and this may or may not have been true in your case. But with frameworks, well, we like to think of them as they allow us to like they keep us dry, right? Like, don't repeat yourself. They keep a common way of solving the same problem throughout your apps, so that basically you can focus on the vertical knowledge you have of whatever you're doing and not have to worry about plumbing. Right, that's the technical argument you make for a framework, and you can make technical arguments go deeper. Like, this particular one does this, which we really like, and so, you know, and you go deep and deep deep with technical. But with a boss, really comes down to, if we switch over to this, it will reduce these costs. It'll reduce maintenance. It'll reduce onboarding new employees, because a new employee comes in, they just have to work the framework, not they have to grab three of our engineers to learn our internal style, or pull the engineer that did this one app and figure their exact style. And that it makes onboarding people easier and therefore cheaper. It makes maintenance easier, therefore cheaper. And it makes it easier to attract people to the organization, because instead of them having to learn something new, they can learn something that's used across the rest of the rest of the industry. So cheaper, and more attractive to potential recruits. That's, you're solving their problems and not your own.
As bosses like to deal with financial and bigger picture things.
In most cases, right? If you have a boss who's too deep in you technically, that's a whole other set of problems. But yeah, I mean, for the most part, you're trying to make it solutions to their problems, which are not, I have to rewrite this logging component every single time I do a new app, right?
You referred to in your presentation about universal and situational solutions. Could you maybe go over that a little bit?
Sure. So the tactics you can divide into the two categories, universal and situational. Universal are ones that you do all the time. Or I should say, you can do them. You need no special requirement to do them. Like, to become an expert, other than taking the time to learn the technology, there's no blocker for you to do that. There's a couple of them. One is demonstrate the technology, become an expert, form trust. So there's a couple ones that are like that. You can just do. Then there are a number of other ones that are much more effective, but the odds of your organization being able to do any or all of them are lower. So, you know, for example, one of them is, what's the name of it? Synergy, right? So you have some sort of industry pressure, like regulation, like, you know, I think one of the best examples of this, you know, was Y2K, right? Y2K or any other sort of like external pressure, like we already have to change things. If we change this thing, it'll help us deal with Y2K. And so you can use that to kind of, the organization already needs to make those changes. And so if you could piggyback your change onto something that fixes the overriding problem, you're good to go. So another one of these sorts of examples are like regulation, right? You have regulation that comes in that you have to change the way you log, and you want to introduce aspect-oriented programming and logging. You know, you can say like, we wouldn't have to rewrite a lot of our code if we just put in this framework or this spring that handles, you know, logging as a secondary concern. We can just do that. Great. That solves that problem. So there are a number of those that you have to have the situation. And if you don't have the situation, well, you can stick with the universal ones, and they are moderately, they're low to moderately effective, depending on your organization.
Do you deal exclusively with change in technology, or do you go outside of it?
Meaning?
Other industries.
Do I talk? Yeah, for the most part, I've talked to other people I know with, like, you know, just randomly start to spark a conversation with them, and they hear about the book. It tends to have a lot of like sales are like, oh yeah, that's what we do. You talk to other people and they'll come up with varying levels of it. But for the most part, I stay focused on tech, just because I, you know, me giving legal advice or advice to lawyers is not usually a good thing for anybody involved. So I think there is overlap with sales. That's the big group. That's the dirty secret, right? That all this stuff is a lot of the stuff you get from sales. Cause when you talk to technology people about this sort of thing, a lot of times you get a little resistance from them picking it on because it feels dirty, right? It feels like you're manipulating, which I can certainly understand that. I can argue against that all you want. But at the end of the day, this is how change happens. It happens through people doing things instead of by, you know, binary, you're right, you're wrong. So you really do need to do convincing, and that convincing is all really squishy, wet, you know, messy people work.
If, let's say, a department was given carte blanche to make some sort of technical change, would you advocate for starting on something small, low risk, or... I presume you wouldn't say, yeah, just throw it at the whole production system.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously it would be irresponsible to say like throw out everything, but it depends really on your, on what your company's position is and what you're doing. I mean, you listen to someone like Joel Spolsky and they'll say like, never throw out code because you're throwing it, you know, like don't start from scratch and rewrite. Because when you do that, you're throwing away like all of this IP and all of these bugs you had. And that's certainly, you know, one way. So when you do change, you would want to do it small. But I think there are plenty of situations where, you know, we need to just burn the boats and start over again. And, you know, I worked for Adobe. And while Adobe didn't burn the technical boats, like Photoshop is... crazy, like the years of IP that are in it, but like from a business and technical perspective, Creative Cloud was them burning the boats, right? They said, we're not going to sell box software anymore, and instead of saying like we're going to gradually phase it in, they just said, nope, next version, bum, done. Like, if you want new stuff, great, you're gonna have to go with Creative Cloud. And there was a lot of friction, there was a lot of like people griping, complaining, and yet today, just an article came out today talking about how successful they've been in doing that change. And in 2.5 years, they've gone from like whatever they didn't have the subscription model to 70% of their income is now coming from subscription instead of from box software in 2 years. So there are cases where I think you have to be bold and decisive and say, burn the boats. But you're really only going to get them, you know, once in a very rare interval, And, you know, when they do, they're the sort of things that people write really, really interesting blog posts and, you know, business cases about.
I'm very inclined to fall on the side of burning it, in the sense that it's been very rare that I've been in a company that they've been proud of their software and of their code, such that they'd really want to protect it from someone stealing it. I've worked for some large companies and some small companies, but I couldn't imagine any of them really being concerned if a competitor got their hands on the code, because much of their value is tied up in their brand and their sales and their infrastructure and all the other things. The source code really was, you could determine what was going on by looking at the page. So yeah. I'm not a big fan of that argument. I can see why Adobe might be more concerned, because to maybe some of their functionality, the speed of graphical manipulations, if someone got their hands on that. But actually, as an aside, wasn't much of the Adobe source code leaked online a year or two ago?
That's a good question. I don't know. I may have been in the process of transitioning in between Adobe and Google, and I was not as focused backwards as I was forward. You know, that does ring a bell. But I meant it more like, you know, when software is your competitive advantage, it's a different story, right? When you're talking about enterprise software that is, we need it, it has to get stuff done. But like every company has the scheduling app, and every company has, you know, but they're just different enough that like you can't buy an off-the-rack solution. I mean, so much of enterprise software is that way, that it's not really competitive advantage. It's just getting the system to work. Obviously those things aren't as valuable from an IP perspective, and so burning it isn't as big a deal. But I still think you need to be careful. Because you end up finding, like, you know, we get these convoluted giant pieces of code, and we think like, oh man, this is terrible. Because, you know, how do I know the code is bad? Because I didn't write it. Which is the cry of every developer, right? Like, you know, if I didn't write it, it's bad code. And when you get a lot of code that you didn't write, your kind of assumption is that it's definitely bad. But you know, it's missing the fact that, yes, there's a lot of code and there's a lot of things, but like there's this one case that we found through 20 hours, you know, 20 days actually of going back and forth with frontline employees to figure out when this particular bug was happening and fix it. So, you know, if the entire system actually is completely crap, then maybe it makes sense to burn it down. But I think in most cases, what we think is actually crap, you know, absolute crap, is just code that we didn't write and therefore we don't like. And therefore, I think in those cases, refactoring, you know, getting stuff into place where you can refactor it and change it so that it is more legible, you know, and then put code reviews as part of your release process so that, like, and make sure that in the code reviews, unreadable code gets dinged, which I've seen happen. Where it's not like the code itself does what it's supposed to do, but it's so convoluted and like we're just not passing it. So I think I disagree. And again, maybe that's my bias because a lot of my software work has been IP based. And what I mean, I'm sorry, intellectual property based at both the Wharton School, Adobe, and even at Google, it is. So I might have a different view on this.
No problem. Just to kind of circle back to something you mentioned earlier, I know that you're not necessarily involved in other fields, but anecdotally from, let's say, conferences you go to, is there any industry that's changing at the rate that software is? Because I was listening to the radio just this evening, and they were talking about maps from 500 years ago, 800 years ago, and long before. And there was an example given that there was a town planning map found from somewhere, I think, in Central Europe. And they said it's comparable to what we use for town planning today. And yet, you know, 15 years ago, it was waterfall. Now it's sort of agile. And I'm sure we're going to move on to something very soon. And if you talk about technology, that's even moving way, way faster.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, I mean, we weren't around and the records aren't as meticulous for the first 50 years of map making, of cartography, right? So it's hard to say whether or not, you know, like, or printing in general, was that something that, you know, where they did a lot of trial and error in the beginning. But I mean, like you talk about, you know, printing today, and the core concept of typography were hashed out in that first 50 to 100 years, and they're still using those same concepts. So I wonder, part of me wonders if we're just moving fast because we're in that critical 50 years, you know, and stuff will slow down. The rate of things like techniques for creating technology will slow down, not actual technology itself. Because technology itself seems to just be accelerating and it's just going to keep going. But like the processes by which we create technology, which is, you know, comparable to the process by which you make a map, are those going to start to crystallize? I think maybe, you know, I don't know. It's hard to, you know, it's hard to see the big picture when you are right in the middle of it. So I wonder about that. Well, is there any other industry that's changing as fast? I think there are a whole lot of industries that are getting disrupted right now through technology. And so change is happening fast there, but it's not the same as technology. You know, you look at transportation, hopefully power joins that list soon. You look at food service.
But on that, power would be a perfect example. I don't believe we're going to have, even if you have new styles of power station, they're not going to fall down, collapse, stop running for days or weeks on end, even if you move to a new technology, unlike oftentimes what happens with software.
True. True. But I mean, I don't know. I think you have to get the right you have to get the apples to apples comparison there, right? Like right now, there's power grid underlying everything, right? And so the only way to really get that experience of like going completely onto a new system is to move into like a house that's off grid that can't be connected to the grid, and you hook up the Tesla battery and some solar panels and see how long you can run. Unless you actually do that, then it's too easy, I think, to, you know, you've got too much of a safety net there, you know. So I think you got to get apples and apples there.
Towards the end of your presentation a couple of weeks ago, you made a comment. This isn't quite a quote, but it was something like, sure. Change is a journey, not a destination. Can you explain that?
Sure. I think a lot of times we have in our heads this sort of, especially when you're younger, you have in your mind when you're trying to advocate for technology change this perfect system, right? Like all the developers are at their desks and they hit submit, and that kicks off a perfect process that runs all these unit tests to make sure the code is good, and then it pushes it to production, and then it pushes it to all the servers, and everything was already done correctly in version control, and everything's backed up, and everything's just perfect. I used to say, like, that is impossible. I work for Google now, and so it is sort of possible. But you need to have the site that amount of resources to throw at the problem. And so, we get discouraged when we're not going to get there, right? Like, because each one of these changes, right? Like you're at a web company and they don't do version control at all, and they don't do code reviews, and continuous integration isn't even like a possibility. And you kind of like, well, why even bother? Because I'll never get to that, like, you know, that holy grail I imagined in the beginning of this exercise. But that's fine, right? Because a organization like that, that then has code reviews added to it, is a better place to be. And that organization that now has, version control added to it, because it's disturbing. I don't know how, I still see a shocking number of places that don't have version control. So like, that's not crazy to say, you know, like, you know, if you don't have version control is better. So I think a lot of times you get this advice, and I got it early on when I was looking for answers to the type of questions I was asking in the book and the prezo. Like, what do I do when my company just won't push change forward? And the answer I always got was, well, you either need to change your organization or change your organization, which I always felt was, I understand where it's coming from, right? But at the end of the day, there are a lot of people who can't just change organizations, right? Like, you know, when I worked for the University of Pennsylvania, the healthcare benefits were amazing. And as a father with young children or young children on the way, that was like, I couldn't just pull up and leave. So, but I think that kind of pithy answer of change your organization or change your organization skips out on like that the actually changing or actually affecting change is really difficult. And there was when I was looking for this, there were no answers for me. And so when I codified it and I kind of came up with these ideas, I shared them. So don't worry about getting to that perfect place. You can change your organization. You can change the what you're in. And between that perfect place and where you are, there are a lot of better places. And that's why it's a journey and not a destination.
If people wanted to find out more, you have a book and a website?
Sure. You can find out. My website is terrenceryan.com, T-E-R-R-E-N-C-E, ryan.com.
I'll put a link in the posting, okay. Of course.
That's so, you know, high tech. The book is Driving Technical Change via Pragmatic Bookshelf. If you want to order it in paper, Amazon's a great way of doing it. If you want to order electronic copies, you have to go to Pragmatic Bookshelf's website, which is pragprog.com.
All right, I'll add a link to that too. Any final notes before we wrap up tonight, Terry?
No, it's been a pleasure being on. And I would say whether or not you buy everything I'm saying, I think it's important to know that tech change is possible. It is possible to change organizations. It is possible to convince people of that their technology choice may be not the right one and that yours may be correct. And that to do so, whether or not you use my method or someone else's, it is going to require you to adopt some change. It's going to you need to get into the world of office politics and persuasion, which some people call manipulation, some people don't. But it's going to require you to go outside of your comfort zone. If you're going to expect people to go outside of their comfort zone with new technology choices, you will have to go outside your comfort zone and learn how to do people change. So whether it's my method or another one, be prepared for that. You need to grow and challenge yourself to do new things. My way is one way of doing that.
Well, thank you very much, Terry Ryan, for your time tonight.
Thank you.
Music was a return by Nisi23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Crime Story by David Zesday from the album Acoustic Guitar.